So I'm now. This is where this is. I'm going to start the part where I became more directly involved in this, and ended up a leader by default of this reform movement. I mentioned there was down here. There's a North American Temple President meeting at Tuaco in September 4th and 5th. And so there was a poll. For example, the polls, they polled the people present. There were 35 voting members, temple presidents. There are fundamental and compelling problems with the guru institution that's presently existed in ISKCON. 94% agreed. And so we had numbers like that. The GBC should regulate the personal use of funds by gurus. 94% agreed. The GBC is now just now getting around to this one, by the way. And 88% thought there'd be significant expansion in the number of initiating gurus in ISKCON and so on. So there was all this almost very high number of people. During this position, a paper came out of LA. I think Virabahu was the principal author. Right after this first meeting, called The First Thousand was the name of the paper. It was The First Thousand Gurus, and it presented the case using quotations that Prabhupada wanted all his disciples to be initiating gurus, and that actually part of the reform would be to make it much easier to have more and more gurus. So he felt that this the Dzogchenacharya system, first of all, gave very few people responsibility for huge numbers of disciples, and this responsibility should be spread around, and that we felt it was spiritually dangerous to have so many disciples. Not only we feared about karmic reaction, but also the ability to take care of, train them, and also the amount of degree of mass worship that sometimes might affect people. So those are the concerns. Really what there was in the Dzogchenacharya system, the reason the GBC can only add new people at a kind of trickle, is that when there was a new person to become initiating guru, some other guru had to take part of his turf, his territory, and give it to the other person. This happened at the beginning, but then it became increasingly difficult. Because there was this implicit property requirement. You had to have your own place to be an initiating guru. The only place I think there was two gurus together was Mayapur. It was Bhavananda and Japitaka Maharaj. But otherwise, everybody had his own exclusive place. So at this first meeting, there was this widespread concern, and then there was a second meeting held, and I was invited to come to this meeting. The meeting in September, October, excuse me. And at that meeting, I was asked to be in charge of a committee to investigate what went wrong with the guru in ISKCON, to do some research. And so that's how I got involved, as a kind of a writer and researcher. So I asked to do that. The chairman of the North American Temple Presidents was Bahudak. The vice chairman was Mahakram Swami. I wasn't an officer or anything. I was just a researcher. So I went back to Philadelphia with our little revolutionary group. It was a little tense because Satsrup Maharaj at that time was quite worried about these Tuaco meetings. And he sent a letter asking that we not disturb the faith of his disciples. You should understand that anytime you this, I thought the people in the Tuaco meeting were very responsible, but as you know, there was people like Kailash Chandra and these people that were quite extreme. Anytime you get a kind of a revolutionary movement, there's always a real extreme wing, as there was with this. And the people who are the target of this revolution look at the extreme wing because of fear and anxiety and sort of thinks everybody is like that. And so that was part of the response of the GBC, is quite understandable, because there were actually people who wanted to and tried to murder gurus during this period. I'll tell about that, but this was actually, there was a violent, extreme means of a violent wing, and other people who wanted to use this process to, as far as possible, get rid of gurus. These people later became the Ritviks, because they were discontent with the way things turned out. Most of us felt that somehow or other we needed to preserve the institution of guru and the guru-disciple relationship as Prabhupada taught it, and it wasn't Shastra, but somehow or other it had to be fitted into ISKCON in a different way. Anyway, so I became the one to find out what went wrong. As my job. And I've handed out to you my early realization on this matter. I don't know what happened to my desk. I had it.
The next step in expansion of ISKCON.
Yeah, that paper that was the first, huh? Yeah, which you received yesterday, or the day if you didn't get it yesterday. And that was what happened. That paper was produced in November. After this meeting, which took place in October. And I'll tell you how it came about. I had started thinking and very intensely about what went wrong in ISKCON and what the difficulty was. And I was in a little meeting discussing this problem with Mahakram Swami, who was the vice chairman of this group, Shesha, who was the temple president of the Philadelphia temple at that time. I was with the BBT and the BI. So we were discussing various things. Makram left the room, and Shesha says to me, "You know, you got to be very careful about what you say in front of him, because he goes and he tells everything to Gurupad, to Satchrup Maharaj." And I went into a kind of state of shock, and I couldn't sleep all night long, because I thought, here we are, the revolutionary reform group, and we can't even trust each other. And it was one of these things where my mind started spinning. And I finally sat down and worked on this paper, which located the problem not in any structural thing, but in the bad Vaishnava relation, the lack of Vaishnava relationships we had with each other in ISKCON. And that this, I said, was the basic root of the problem. And I refer back in the beginning of the paper to the fratricidal war, because I was beginning to realize that this whole process has got this feature of the same thing of two groups of fallen people accusing each other of being fallen. That we were supposedly the revolutionary group, the purifying group, and we had the same problems as everybody else. We couldn't trust each other, we couldn't get along with each other. And so my argument was that our problem in ISKCON is that we were a Kanishta Adhikari society. Now, since I would get myself into a great deal of trouble saying that the gurus were Kanishta Adhikaris, since the official doctrine was that they were Uttama Adhikaris, I kind of pulled my punch on that one. There's a little weasel wording around here. But essentially I say, no matter how advanced they are, everyone's acting like a Kanishta Adhikari, whose major tendency is fault-finding. And so I describe ISKCON in this way. A society of devotees in which, I'm reading from the first page here, in the middle, A society of devotees in which proper Vaishnava relations are not yet the norm is called a Kanishta Adhikari society. Its distinguishing characteristic is contentiousness, that's argumentativeness, arising from envy. Envy is a product of false ego. Because of false ego, the members are unable to establish spiritual friendships among themselves. Instead, they vie with each other, compete with each other for prestige, power, and prerequisites. Intensely desiring the honor and respect of others, the contentious neophyte pretends to be more advanced than he actually is. He tries to conceal his shortcomings and fall downs, and in so doing he develops a secretive mentality and holds himself back from entering into open and honest relations with his godbrother. Godbrothers, because he cannot reveal his mind in confidence, he remains aloof from real fellowship. He strays from the path of devotional service, but his peers do not help him. For he thinks that if he allows someone to preach to him, he implicitly admits his own subordination. Therefore, he cuts himself off from hearing and becomes impervious to instruction or good advice. Because he has many secret misgivings about himself, he becomes eager to find the faults of others. In this way, he reassures himself of his own superiority in spite of his many unacknowledged weaknesses. This is my description of what it was like to be an ISKCON at that time. And then I say that before, that really the real problem is our whole society has to make advancement. Many of these same points, by the way, I later discovered in the books of Anton Poison, which I didn't find that book until about 1989 or 90. But this I had already begun to realize that something is going on here. And I say that, you know, our real business isn't politics, but reform, and that a devotee has to begin reform with himself. And that you can't reform unless you're working on the platform of at least anartha nirvritti, removing your own anarthas. Because that, if you want to reform relationships, you have to reform yourself and become honest about yourself and then rectify your relationships. And then again, on page 3, I talk about the situation in ISKCON. If you want to start having Vaishnava relationships, I say most devotees will discover that few, if any, of their relationships are satisfactory. The devotee will probably see that he has almost no confidential friends, that he does not and cannot trust most of his associates. He's conscious that many of his associates have made accommodations, sometimes quite extensive, to sense gratification. Indeed, he has participated in many meetings in which the faults and shortcomings of those not present have been thoroughly examined. Yet the established patterns of relationships are such that while everyone is free to talk about someone, no one is free to talk to them. In this situation, devotees find themselves standing helplessly by as they watch one of their associates sink deeper and deeper into Maya until he finally bloops. No one is able to come to his aid. As the failing devotee falls further and further away, the criticism of him intensifies, but no one helps. So anyway, I go on with this kind of description. So I had written this paper. You have to read it some other time to get the whole effect of it, I guess. I wrote this paper dealing with personal reform, because this is my realization. My first realization was that it's not that they're the enemy, we're the enemy. You know, there's an American, famous American cartoon character from the 50s called Pogo, a little swamp rat or something, or possum. He used to run in all the funny papers. He was a philosophical possum. You know what a possum is? You don't have those here. I don't know. So it's some kind of animal. And one of Pogo's sayings is, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." So that was my realization, and that if you want to reform anything, it has to be self-reform. And kind of there was this sort of duplicity built into the movement at the present time, and that was really what had been carried up, now up to the level of gurus and acharyas, even. But it was all pervading, and that's what we really need to do. So this was advocating, and I realized that if I'm going to start criticizing, as a my profession, other devotees, including acharyas and things like that, I had better be in good shape myself. And so I had realized that, I had gotten really sloppy in my sadhana and devotional life. And boy, I really started, working very hard on my sadhana. Because I did discover that if you point your finger at somebody else, if you're not yourself trying to become pure, it's going to blow up in your face. And I watched this happen, because so many people engage in this kind of stuff that they're purifying other people as a substitute for actually working on themselves. And that's fault finding. So I put these realizations in this paper, and I sent it to about two people. I had to do by mail, The communications technology at this date is duplicating machines, photocopy machines. As yet, there are no fax machines. At least they're not spread around very well. People in ISKCON did not have fax machines. They came in a little later. Certainly no email. So this whole thing was done by photocopy. Because before photocopy, there were stencils, and that was really slow. But now you could take a paper and run off a lot of copies. But then you had to put them in envelopes and mail them out to people. So that's what I did. I mailed out a few copies, maybe three copies to people, to Bahudak, who is the leader, and a few other people. And within a week, these copies of this paper are all over the movement. The people who got my copy duplicated a bunch and sent it out to everybody else. And within a week, I was getting calls from Hawaii. Why didn't you send me a copy of your paper? It just spread like wildfire. It really hit a nerve with people. Although Bahudak didn't like it so much. He says, all right, it's okay, but this is what we really want. We really got to give it to these guys, He was more ferocious about this kind of thing. And some people, like Rameshwara Swami, really responded quite negatively to this. In fact, I was on the BBT payroll, and the ultimate result was I got removed from the BBT payroll because of my activities in writing this paper. And Rameshwara sent out word, this came out in November, this is very, very bad, it will discourage everybody, it'll wreck the Christmas marathon. That's the ultimate, it's bad for book distribution, after that, you're finished. But I was happy, actually, to get a card from L.A. It was one of these cards you buy in a store. It said, on the top it said, good job. And the inside it said, thank you. And it was signed by all of Rameshwar's top book distributors. They're all, most of them women. It said, at last somebody is telling the truth or something. So they were actually encouraged. So, of course, I realized I called this a preliminary report because I knew there was no research behind this or anything like that. So that was my realization. And my second realization was that whatever process was taking place, Krishna was really in control. This became another clear to me. Krishna was doing something to try to purify the movement. And if you wanted to act as Krishna's instrument, you yourself had to be pure. And that I realized that the people who were running the movement, the gurus and the GBC, for all their faults, they were people who were willing to work very, very, very hard and take on a lot of responsibility for Srila Prabhupada and the movement. And if they were inadequate, then the only thing you could do that was constructive is to make sure that there was other people who would work just as hard, but maybe who wouldn't have the same faults or anarthas or whatever as they had. It was really on us. You can't just sit around and criticize and accuse people and not have anything better to offer. And I said, in this reform group, I began to realize that there were people who were revengeful, punitive, wanted to purify others as a substitution for purifying themselves. There was this other part of the radical wing was a devotee from New Vrindavan named Sulochan, who was later murdered. This is he had a quarrel with Kirtanananda. Kirtanananda had initiated his wife without his permission, and Sulochan didn't like this very much. He was an advocate that the husband is the spiritual master enough for any woman, but unfortunately he was not very strict, and the wife was having a lot of crisis of faith in her husband / spiritual master. Meanwhile, they're living in New Vrindavan, and everybody's going, you know, bhakti 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 bhakti. So he was out of town, and Kirtananda initiated her, and so he left New Vrindavan. His wife didn't want to leave, so he basically, his marriage split up over this issue. He went to the West Coast, very discontent, and who should he run into but Kailas Chandra, who convinces him that, oh, it's not just Bhaktipat, it's all the gurus. They're all wicked and evil. And Sulochan considered himself a kshatriya, and Kailas Chandra seemed to back up this idea, and that he should take some action of a kshatriya nature against the corrupt gurus. And just as this whole thing is undergoing, starting up, and this reform movement starts, and some of my papers go out, I get the reputation as a leader, and I get a letter from Sulochan. And Sulochan says to me in this letter, your reform movement is very nice and it has good intentions and everything, and I'm happy for that. But he says, it won't work. He said, you're like Mahatma Gandhi, but I'm like Subhash Chandra Bose. You all understand that reference, huh? Uh-huh. And there has to be violence. I have the letter still. That's what he said. He was on the West Coast passing out papers, Kailas Chandra said, he wrote them, called the ISKCON Games. It was an expose of all the gurus. So he was really serious about killing a guru or two. I mean, that was Sulochan's. And of course, he ultimately got murdered because somebody trying to protect a guru killed him. That's a little bit in the future. Then what happened there was in August of 85. So this, anyway, this North American Temple president thing is sort of becomes a big deal. And the GVC in 85, at the beginning of 85 in February, again tries to start to change things. They make more gurus in 85. Well, first of all, they pass a resolution that the GVC zonal secretary, whether initiating or not, is the ultimate managerial authority within his zone as the official representative of the GVC body. They actually had to pass that resolution. But you see, what had happened, like, for example, in North America, here's an example. Kirtanananda Swami was the initiating guru for Canada. Somebody else who, I guess, Jagadish was an initiating guru, was the GBC. So Kirtananda was the initiating guru for Canada, or at least Eastern Canada. And at a certain point, he began to tell his disciples that when they went on Sankirtan, they should send money to New Vrindavan. He just told them directly, didn't ask the temple presidents. So the temple presidents went to him and said, you know, this is not right that you should tell your disciples to send their monies out of the zone and to New Vrindavan. And he didn't listen to them and continued to have his disciples send their money away from the temples they were in and to New Vrindavan. So the temple presidents in Canada, Eastern Canada, naturally got pretty upset with Kirtananda. And I guess they said a few things about how they're upset with him. And so Kirtananda declared that these temple presidents were all offenders against the gurus, that their disciples couldn't hear them things, and he instructed his disciples to leave the temples in Canada and go to New Vrindavan, which most of them did. And Eastern Canada temples went into a collapse from which they have yet to recover. These are the kind of things that were happening. Who had the real power, if they wanted it, was the initiating guru. So the GBC could pass resolutions like this, but whether it really worked or not was another thing. So that was one of the problems that would... And especially we are having more and more trouble with Kirtananda in North America. They also passed a resolution that said that an initiating guru may belong to any ashram. Interesting. And they then they said in the same year that Bhakti Tirtha Swami, Jagadish Goswami can begin to give diksha. Worship of an acharya outside of his Prabhu Datta Desh is not obligatory beyond ordinary etiquette according to a sannyas or senior Vaishnavas. Agrani is empowered to give diksha, Gaur Govinda Swami, with a little condition. No books published by Hamsa Duda or any of his followers should be purchased by ISKCON temples or devotees. And so they're trying to kind of loosen things up at the beginning of 85. All acharyas should personally make it clear to their disciples that he is not offended if his godbrothers do not chant his pranam mantras in kirtan and do not attend his guru puja. So you can see what that was. So then what happened in 85 after that meeting? There was a meeting of the North American GBC together with the temple presidents in New Vrindavan, I guess to try to talk over this growing feeling of crisis about the gurus. And in that meeting, something else was going. At that time, I had finally written this. Somebody had sent me anonymously a copy of Prajumna's letter. I read the letter and I thought, boy, there it is. That's the thing that really went wrong in ISKCON. You know, Prajumna's analysis of the sense of the difference between being an initiating guru and being an acharya at the head of the institution. We were just not clear about that difference. We thought, and I can see why people thought that because that's what a guru meant, that you were also the acharya at the head of an institute, because that's what Prabhupada was. But it eclipsed the GBC, and you had many institutions with a single acharya at the head. And so that paper under my order, I had prepared in time for this North American GBC meeting in New Vrindavan. At the same time, there were doubts about other gurus functioning. There was doubts about Rameshwar. Many people believe he did not chant his rounds. There were doubts about Bhavananda. There were rumors of his having various sorts of sexual indiscretions with men. Kirtanananda's starting worrying a lot of people too. So, but somehow in New Vrindavan we meet together. And what had happened before that meeting was that there was a devotee had come from India to stay at the Atlanta temple, and he was a very upset devotee, and finally he told the temple president in Atlanta that in Vrindavan he had been in Vrindavan, and he was Bhavananda had made a sexual advances on him. This was a guy who's about, you know, 20, 21 years old, and that Bhavananda, and this had put a really in a state and confusion. He was disturbed and trying to figure it out and what was wrong. Uttama Adhikari, you know, what was he doing? Groping him and all these other kind of things. And so the temple president typed up this devotee's statement and had him sign it, notarized, and then brought it to Balavanta, who was the president of the GBC that year. And so Balavanta got a committee. It was himself and Trivikram Maharaj and one other person, I forgot who, to meet with Bhavananda and talk to him about, they interviewed this kid, and they met with, were going to meet with Bhavananda as soon as activity, this committee. And Trivikram told me about it. That's how I knew about this, and he showed me this statement. And it just so happened, by coincidence, that the time the committee could meet with Bhavananda was at this meeting in New Vrindavan. The North American GBC meeting and Temple President's meeting. So everybody's gathered together. Everybody knows the reform group of the Temple Presidents have this paper. And I passed this paper out. And which you have in this group, the one called Under My Order. It's the second paper in here about how we... I have long dates for meetings in here, but anyway, it's about the appointment tape, quotes Topanga Canyon, and basically it's an expansion of and commentary on Prajumna's letter, which I saw also included at the end of this paper to people. And Bhaduk says, "Yeah, this is all we're looking for." Bhaduk. And the paper went out, and everybody got all excited about it, and seemed to, you know, that really hit the nail on the head, that pinpointed what the real problem was. So then the other thing that happened is that three people met with Bhavananda and confronted him with the statement of this young man. And Bhavananda confessed. He admitted it was true. And so the GBC had just gotten this paper of mine under my order, which kind of really shook people up. I mean, up until that point, many of them, some of them had been sort of going along with the whole thing, but this one really, it had an edge to it. At the beginning of this paper, I'll just show you, at the beginning of this paper, I quote Srila Prabhupada, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, at the time of his departure, requested all his disciples to form a governing body and conduct missionary activities cooperatively. He did not instruct a particular man to become the next Acharya. But just after his passing away, his leading secretaries made plans without authority to occupy the post of Acharya, and they split into two factions over who the next Acharya would be. Consequently, both factions were asar, or useless, because they had no authority, having disobeyed the order of the spiritual master. So later on in this paper, after I make my case that the order of Prabhupada was misunderstood, we thought we stayed together, we still had a GBC, but in fact, we established a lot of acharyas in this sense, who were thought of themselves as absolute. And then on page 5, I say we have to make a rectification of this mistake. And this is what I wrote. If we do not change, some future Acharya emerging out of the shambles of a dismantled ISKCON will pass the same kind of judgment on us that Srila Prabhupada passed on his deviant godbrothers. If we do not change, this future Acharya will be able to write. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, at the time of his departure, requested all of his disciples to conduct missionary activities cooperatively under the authority of a governing body. He did not instruct any particular men to become the next Acharyas. But just after his passing away, his leading secretaries made plans without authority to occupy the post of Acharya. The single international society established by Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada gradually split into many small local movements, each headed by a single self-made Acharya. Consequently, all these factions were asara, or useless, because they had no authority, having disobeyed the order of the spiritual master. So, I mean, I admit it. I mean, I was like being a little rough. And so this was a plea, though, to rectify this situation. So this paper went out, and Bhavananda confessed. The other thing that happened, was this little document, anonymously, was being circulated, called 13 Points to Save ISKCON. And it proposed that that we attend to this crisis, that there should be a vote of confidence, no confidence in the GBC members by the local people, that every unqualified disciple in ISKCON after the disappearance of the spiritual master has a right to initiate. Any devotee who initiates should not occupy a position involving hands-on management. So again, this is surfaced so many years later.
Anyone who initiates?
Who initiates. Separation of guru function from management function. That was still being discussed. Guru should be able to initiate anywhere in the world, irrespective of zonal boundaries, with the cooperation of the local leaders. There will only be one Vyasasana for any speaker of Srimad Bhagavatam. In other words, you get to only have a single Vyasasana. These kind of proposals. Anonymous, but everybody knew it came from Dallas, and that Tamal Krishna Goswami had endorsed it, although his name isn't on it. So that also was an impetus, that there were GBCs who were strong, who were now in favor of reform. So when the combination of this and the Under My Order paper and Bhavananda, the shock of Bhavananda's confession, it just took the wind out of the sails of many of the GBC. And so they agreed then that we need to have an emergency meeting of the entire GBC. And they called it the next month, for September in New Vrindavan in 85. They also said there should be an Ishtagosthi of Prabhupada disciples all over ISKCON. And the GBC passed some of the key proposals of at this reform group at that emergency meeting. So that the emergency meeting was called for the next month. Well, it was very interesting. Bhavananda went to New York. He had a meeting with his disciples. He confessed. He was humble. He was contrite, in a repentant mood. When he showed up at the emergency meeting, his mood had changed completely. He had turned around and was again not in a humble, contrite mood. And at this emergency meeting, there was this Ishtagosthi of the Prabhupada disciples. We are all sitting on a equal level. For the first time I mentioned this, the GBC, the gurus are not on higher seats. Kirtanananda boycotted the meeting. Although it was in New Vrindavan, he wasn't coming. because he didn't approve of it, and he had issued a paper about that. But also, at the previous emergency meeting, the North American GBC had said that he had made a mistake in initiating. It was wrong for him to have initiated Sulochan's wife without his permission. And so in protest for this, he was not going to attend any more functions. So he didn't attend this, the Easter Goshti at all, nor did his people. This was going on in New Vrindavan, but everybody in New Vrindavan was sort of boycotting the whole thing. And then, but later on, he came in and addressed the meeting. Yeah. It was very interesting what happened. So he's out of it, and we have several days of discussion in Easter Goshti where different devotees are. To see what to do. And I sometimes have called into the GBC meeting as a representative of the temple presidents. And the GBC at that point was in a mood to make some changes. And so when I caucused with the leaders of our reform group, everybody was clear that that one remedy for the situation we thought was to expand the number of gurus. That would eliminate this exclusive position. And then there was all this discussion about what to do about the level of worship of gurus. Some wanted no vyasasanas, guru puja, no guru puja, you know, all this ritual stuff. What should we do? And there was no agreement about what you should do. And then I realized that it was a fact that this, that the Dzogchen Acharya position was symbolized by this exclusive vyasasana. Why if even if Acharya gurus are special and need to have special seats or vyasasanas, why are there two? Why not just have one seat that any initiating guru can sit in? And I realized that the exclusive vyasasana was really the symbol of the system. And I also realized that because we're a religious movement, the nature of religions are, if you destroy this symbol, you destroy the reality. And so the only other proposal we came to the GBC is expand the number of gurus and eliminate the exclusive vyasasana. Just have one vyasasana in the temple room that any initiating guru could sit on. That was just two proposals. It was kind of neat. And it was interesting because people were saying, you know, there isn't any Dzogchen Acharya system, we never passed a resolution. When the Vyasasana thing came up, there was a real lot of feeling that went into discussion about this thing. The upshot of the thing is that the GBC did several things at this meeting. One thing is they excommunicated Sulochan from ISKCON. By then he had begun to threaten people's lives, and he was excommunicated. And then they decided that to become an initiating guru with ISKCON, what would be required was if anybody, any Prabhupada disciple was approached to initiate, if that disciple could get the approval of three GBC members, that person could begin to initiate. That's what they would open the number of gurus up that way. Just require the approval of three GBCs. This was their decision. And then the other determination, then they put Bhavananda on indefinite probation. And said that any ISKCON guru may sit on any Vyasasana, except of course Prabhupada's, anywhere in the world. And then later on they revisited the Vyasasana issue. Let me see what they said. Oh, another thing that they wanted to do, that came forward, another reform proposal, was that the GBC had worked that most votes in the GBC required a two-thirds majority. To get any resolution passed in the GBC required a two-thirds majority. When Prabhupada was president, it was 50%. But then it became two-thirds. You understand what this means? This means that a small group of people can stop anything. And the small group of people being the initiating gurus. They formed a caucus, and you needed two-thirds to get anything done. They could stop anything. So another principle of reform was go back to 51%. They resolved there should be only one Vyasasana other than Prabhupada's in each temple, and there shall be no guest Vyasasana. So that's what the GBC agreed to at this emergency meeting. So once they agreed to this three signature thing, there was a little caucus, and then people, this is how I became an initiating guru. For political reasons, because they said, you know, they've opened it up. We've got to have some people. And people said to me, you know, you've got to become an initiating guru. And then I, I had to take a day and think about that one. You know, I mean, there was nobody wanted to get initiated from me or anything like that. You know. But they said, you know, we just have to take advantage. And some of us, they said, you really have to do it. And I thought about it. And to be a guru the way many people were, like a kind of very big ceremonial entity, was really something that at least didn't appeal to my taste, you know. That ritual aspect of guru I didn't like very much. But when I considered that a guru meant to be a teacher, I thought I could do that. That was something I was trained to do, and I thought I could handle being a teacher. And then did I have to be, you know, an Uttama Adhikari and all that other kind of stuff? That was the next question, you know, how advanced was I? Well, I knew I was pretty good at strictly following. And then I ran across this purport. I just happened to open the Bhagavatam to this purport from the fourth canto, where I must have it somewhere. Let's see if I got it. I can find it. Where the earth talks about following the directions of the previous acharyas, and in that one Prabhupada again quotes that Amar Ajnaya Guru Hana, or he refers to it, and he says that the Krishna consciousness movement has to go on, has to be directed by liberated souls because they're free from four defects. And he says that when that's done, then it's properly directed. But then he says, in the course of this, he says, we are following people who are strictly following the supreme liberated Krishna. He says, even though a follower may not be liberated, if that person is strictly following the orders of the spiritual master of Krishna, all his actions are naturally liberated from the influence of material nature. Therefore, Lord Chaitanya says, under my order, you become guru. And so I remember where that the role that played in the appointment tapes. And so so on that basis, I decided, okay, well, I don't know. You know, I don't have to claim to be liberated, but I have to be strictly following. And if you're strictly following, Prabhupada basically says that it's the same effect as being liberated. So because of that particular purport, I agreed to do this. And so I got three signatures. I got Tamal Krishna Goswami's signature. I got Satrup Maharaj's signature. I got Ridayananda Maharaj's signature. So that's how it happened in my particular case. So that was like the beginning of these reforms began to be instituted. But then what happened is that the next GBC meeting, there was an attempted counter-revolution led by Bhagavan. He was very upset by this thing. Oh, the other thing was of course, right after this meeting, Kirtananda got attacked. There was a crazy guy named Tri Yugi. It seemed like he had nothing to do with this meeting or anything. He was somebody who was living in New Vrindavan. Oh, I forgot to tell you about what Kirtananda did anyway. Now, let me tell you what he did. He hadn't participated in the meeting, and then we heard that in Bhagavatam class from the Vyasasana, he was going to give us a lecture about the position of the guru. And we thought, oh boy, you know, what a thing that is, you know, use all his positions, sit on the asana, or all sit down and announce the truth ex cathedra, you know? So we let it be known that if that happened, we were all going to walk out of the class. So that plan got canceled, and then he wanted to address the meeting, the Istagosti. So everybody's sitting on the floor, same level. And the first thing that happens, a guy walks in with a big chair and sits it down. Kirtananda walks in and sits in the chair. You know, we're all down there, and he's up there. And then his followers all come in for the first time. And at that time, Umapati was one of his followers. And Umapati says, "We love you, Srila Bhaktipat." It's a huge room. You know, "We love you, Srila Bhaktipat." And he says, "Be quiet. You can't say that in here." So that was the beginning, you know, of his. But the whole thing was just the language of furniture at this point. So he really objected to this. To this meeting, and then after this, he got clobbered over the head, really badly, by this devotee. And then, actually, it was at that point Harikesh Maharaj came and delivered this lecture in New Vrindavan, blaming the violence on the meeting that had created such chaos and anxiety and offense. That this was a meeting and Karikesh's zone and Bhavananda's zone. It was a Daksha Yajna, you know. It was compared to that, and that's why actually we had taped it, the Istagosti, and we printed up, you know, transcript of it and sent it around to people just to counteract the idea that it was some kind of horrible continuous blasphemy of devotees and things like that. It was actually a fairly civil meeting. But then when Kirtananda got out, I mean, things got more and more extreme. So anyway, there was the 86 GBC meeting, which was the counter-revolution attempt. But it was interesting because, in a way, the counter-revolution was fairly cosmetic. They passed a resolution. The GBC body considers that the meeting held at New Vrindavan in September 1985 was not properly called and held according to the existing rules and procedures. So they basically realized the whole meeting was illegitimate and just disowned it that way. Nevertheless, they adopted most of the reform measures with slight modification that were passed at the emergency meeting. They voted that a simple majority instead of two-thirds will be used to change ISKCON laws. They tightened up the requirement to be initiating guru they thought that three signatures was too loose, but by then everybody had agreed, because somehow or other a devotee named Maharam managed to get three signatures. Nobody knew how. And everybody thought he was off his rocker. And somehow he got three signatures. So we're quite willing to have it be tightened up. So the new rule was, at this time, any GBC can present a Diksha Guru candidate before the GBC body unless the majority of voting members objects to the nomination. The candidate's put on a one-year waiting list, and then if there's any problems, then after year one he's reviewed again, and he can get his he can then be approved. However, the GBC gave its blessing to those who had begun to give formal initiation September 1985, which was the meeting. So at that point, Lokanath Swami, Bhakti Abhay Charan Swami, Maharam, who I mentioned already, Veer Krishna Swami, Virabahu, Paramananda from Gitanagari, Charu, Narahari, Radhakrishna Swami, Mahanidhi Swami, Romapada Swami, Niranjana Swami, Navayogendra Swami, Rupanuga, myself, Vipamukya, all these people got them. The GBC gave their okay. So basically they let that go on. They made the Vyasasana a local option. So they tightened up that if you wanted to have two Vyasasanas or one, it was a local option. One thing that happened had already happened in India, however, after the emergency meeting in New Vrindavan, a bunch of Prabhupada disciples in India and in the Radha Damodar temple went and tore out the two Vyasasanas. In Radha Damodar temple. Right, there's Prabhupada's Vyasasana, and they were built into the pillars on either side, marble Vyasasanas, the guest Vyasasana, and the Lokacharya Vyasasana. In Krishna Balaram temple. Yeah. Did I say? I'm sorry, I'm getting tired now. Whenever I do that, tell me. So in Krishna Balaram temple, there was these two Vyasasanas that had been built in, right in the front of Prabhupada's Vyasasana. When they tore them out, they discovered that these two Vyasasanas for the Acharyas had covered up the plaque, one on one side in English and the other side in Bengali, that proclaimed Prabhupada to be the founder Acharya of ISKCON. Just see! That was one thing that happened. They had already... So anyway, the GBC made that a local option, but by then most places had made the change already and weren't going to change back, and there was just one Vyasasana other than Prabhupada's in the temple room. But the thing that they did that was really controversial, that they had a secret ballot vote, and by one, a majority of one, they agreed that in October of that year, 86, Bhavananda could resume initiating. And that really, really got people upset. And there was more, but it was cosmetic. Bhagavan stacked the temple president's meeting. Remember, the revolutionary group was the temple president's meeting. Prabhupada had given them, after the 76 incident, he had let the temple president have temple presidents meet and approve the GBC meetings and make suggestions. So the temple presidents had been empowered by Prabhupada after that 76 incident. And so that was the locus, Bauduk was in charge of the International Temple President's Body, and Bhavananda got to pass a resolution that it would no longer be the Temple President's meetings, it would be the manager's meetings. And then all these people had come from his zone, and one was the minister of cooks, the other was the minister of this, the minister of that, and he had all these people who were ministers and regional secretaries and all kinds of... He had his whole list of titles, all of whom were managers. And so he flooded the meeting with his men. And Bauduk, kept getting outvoted. because Bhagavan stacked the meeting.
Bhagavan
did this. This is all the European people from Bhagavan. He had stacked the meeting. And boy, I mean, Baladuk was really, really discouraged. In fact, after that, he dropped out, you know. He left ISKCON. But he had told me, actually, that he had personal problems and that he realized that he was attacking these people, but he was just as bad himself. He is compromised in his own principles, and that he was somewhat of a tyrannical manager, and he had a revolution back in Vancouver by his own people. And so he found himself in the same position as the people whom he was attacking. So he got discouraged and left. But it really wasn't because of them. It was his own problems, which he admitted. You know. So the following year, after this attempted counter-revolution led by Bhagavan, who was keeping Bhavananda sort of the emblem of the guy that, you know, was being mistreated by the temple presidents. He obviously had done so much to spread Krishna consciousness. And his line was, and many of the other people's line didn't like this, what have you done to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world? And that was the famous put-down line. Then there was something to it, you know. But in the next year, in 86, what happened is that the GBC began to back away like crazy from supporting Bhavananda. Then Rameshwara got caught in the Santa Monica Mall by some of his disciples with a woman. He was walking around with a 16-year-old girl. He was dressed in Karmi clothes, really spiffed out very nicely, and they were out shopping together. And his disciples encountered him, and they had an interesting conversation, which was spread all over. And so an investigation began of Rameshwara. Then a letter came from Bhagavan, saying that he had formed an attachment to a woman named Ram Tulsi and was resigning as GBC and guru. All this happened in 1986. And then Kirtanananda, Sulochan was murdered by a Kirtanananda hitman. Sulochan was in L.A. He had just wanted to murder, he wanted to assassinate, I guess is the right word. He wanted to assassinate Kirtanananda, decided it was too hard. So he was instead going to try to assassinate Rameshwara. So there was Rameshwara security agents kind of tagging this guy around. He was in disguise and going from place to place. And then some people came from New Vrindavan to help them. One of them was a guy by the name of Tirtha, who had been trained as a killer by the United States government in Vietnam. So he had valuable skills. Been a soldier in Vietnam, and Tirtha discovered where this found they were keeping watch on Sulochan, and Tirtha went up. Sulochan was sitting in the van and shot him in the head twice. That's what Tirtha did. So all of a sudden Sulochan is going around passing out papers about the ISKCON game and all this other stuff, and everybody dismissing him as a nut. Once he was murdered, his stature increased immensely in credibility in the eyes of the police, and they began an investigation into his murder. And Tirtha, for some reason, left a bride trail leading back right back to him in New Vrindavan. The car he was using, he had rented at the airport using his photo ID and stuff like that. And so they quickly concluded that this was a professional hit, and that New Vrindavan or Kirtananda was behind it. They found, because this was started in West Virginia and happened in California, it went across state lines, and so the federal government came in, the FBI investigated. They started to find out how New Vrindavan was making its money, and all of a sudden there's a whole prosecutor from the federal government, Justice Department, investigating New Vrindavan. This starts to happen the same year. So there was
why
an.
Why did it publicize?
Huh?
Why did it publicize?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. All of a sudden the newspapers are just going to town on this whole thing. Yeah. They're going to town. This reporter from the San Jose Mercury News named John Huebner wrote a two-part series called Crime and the Krishnas. Starting with Kirtananda, he had met Kirtananda somehow, I mean, starting with Hamsa Duda had unburdened his soul to this reporter. it was quite something to see. And then he also taught about Kirtananda and what went on there. So, as you see in this timeline, the next thing that happens is that there is a few meetings. The GBC is getting pretty worried. And in San Diego, in August, that August, yes, in 86, there's a North American GBC meeting, and they deal with problems of Bhavananda, Rameshwar, Kirtananda. I have the meetings of that here. And they say they worry about Bhavananda. They say they want him to follow the following guidelines. They're not going to let him initiate again in October, like the GBC. Instead, he has to follow the following guidelines till the next GBC meeting. Live in ISKCON temples at all times. Attend the full morning program. Read Prabhupada's books at least 1 hour daily. Chant 16 rounds. Stop criticism of others. Stop ethnic slurs of any kind. Stop reading mundane literature, watching television, going to movies, own or wear only a minimum amount of Western clothes, shave hair regularly, carry a dunda, wear Brahmin thread and neck beads at all times. This is an initiating guru. See, I mean, people have been making the case that, you know, we need Uttama Adhikari gurus in order to have ISKCON go on. What you see the problem is with these people they're having is they wouldn't even last in a bhakta program. Reduce toiletries. Do not travel in first class. Do not travel with baladas. As you know, Bhavananda had some homosexual inclinations, and I guess I don't know what was happening with Bala. He may be completely innocent, but people were worried. He always had this attractive young man with him. So they wanted him to accept these proposals in writing. The GBC body accepts Kirtananda Swami's assurance to take a voluntary suspension of his GBC duties upon being indicted by any grand jury. In America, the system is, before you get charged of a crime, there's a thing called a grand jury, 20 people or so, who hear the prosecutor's case and give the okay. This is the English system that America follows with this grand jury. There was a grand jury investigating Kirtananda. In fact, I got subpoenaed to talk in front of it. That's a whole other. The Kirtananda thing is a whole. I can't get into that whole story, but when he was indicted, accused of these crimes, he didn't resign. Even though he said he was going to. So they took several statements to show they're very worried about Kirtananda. Again, that the founder acharya title be only used for Srila Prabhupada. Dogs will not be allowed inside any ISKCON temple. They asked him to stop any further publications of the writings of Srila Prabhupada without the prior written agreement of the North American BBT trustees. He was publishing BBT literature on his own. Really, what he had done, if you see these, the other thing is that basically he had now his own movement going. He was going anywhere he wanted, everywhere he wanted, opening his own Bhaktipad temples. He was not at this point answerable or answering to the GBC at all. He was under investigation by the government, and they were really worried about him. Next thing, Rameshwara Swami has requested the GVC body to give him a leave of absence from his GVC and guru functions until the 1987 Mayapur meeting, at which time his situation will be reviewed. It was discovered after the Santa Monica Mall encounter, in which he admitted to at least not behaving like a sannyasi. There was an investigation, and somehow or other they found in the trash can or something his credit card bill, where he had charged restaurants, movies, and he was leading a very active social life, dating this young girl. And so there was all kinds of turmoil in the Los Angeles community, and it was clear that Rameshwara had very serious problems. So the GBC backed away from Bhavananda. Rameshwara had these problems. Kirtananda they're really worried about. And very soon thereafter, out of this blue, came this letter from Bhavananda saying that he was now formed this alliance with this woman and wanted to...
Bhagavan.
I'm sorry. Yeah. So the next thing that happened that year is we had a meeting of the North American Temple presidents in Chicago November. At that point, I became president of this organization because Baudoc had dropped out because of his own problems. And because of those problems, he had become unnecessarily discouraged, I thought. In the Chicago meeting, we added the North American Prabhupada disciples to our group. And we said we had the proposal that the has to be something that now the GBC has to do to restore faith in itself. This endorsement that they gave of Bhavananda just completely everybody just lost faith, and that they had to, like Brahma casting off his impure body, the GBC had to undergo some process of self renewal or self rectification. So we had resolutions to restore firm faith in the GBC. You have to understand something. That part of our major concern was, at least my concern, was that the authority of the GBC be established. So you'll have to notice that in no time did any of this happen against the will of the GBC. At any time the GBC had said to me, stop, don't have a meeting, don't write any papers, I wouldn't have done it. They never got together and agreed to that. I mean, I would have stopped if I was ordered to do so. But somehow or other, there was enough support for this on the GBC that we were allowed to keep on going. This differs from the so-called current ISKCON reform movement. Because we couldn't very well say our business is to establish the authority of the GBC and then break it, you know, not recognize it ourselves. So when at that meeting anyway, there was this idea of a some kind of renewal. We asked the GBC to remove Kirtananda. And then, in December, in Dallas, Texas, there was a GBC meeting, a North American GBC meeting. And Tamal Krishna at that time was the chairman of the GBC. And at that meeting, he set up the mechanism for this so-called Committee of 50. And the idea that there would be 50 Prabhupada disciples who were peers of the GBC and gurus but weren't on it, that would sit and vote on each GBC member, confidence or no confidence. And that committee would then gather in 1987 at the GBC meeting. And so a mechanism of having some people who would put that committee together and show up, and that committee would then have to be approved by the GBC body, because Tamal Krishna had no authority just to do it single-handedly. He would just have the 50 people show up. and then request the GBC body to constitute this as an advisory committee. And so that's what happened at that meeting. And then anyway, there are many interesting issues that were raised at this time. By the time we went to this finally 87 meeting, everything really came to a head. The first thing that happened in 87 in February was a North American Temple President's meeting, at which we passed a resolution requesting the GBC to expel Kirtananda Swami. Kirtananda had gotten considerably more dangerous to ISKCON, and the GBC didn't seem to be able to do anything about it because he was now claiming that there was a government plot against Hinduism, and that's why he was being investigated. And because so many Indians in America were going to New Vrindavan as a place of pilgrimage, he had a mailing list all over America, and using that mailing list, he was asking Indians to back him and support him against this attack on Hinduism. When Sulochan was killed, everybody in ISKCON knew that Kirtananda was behind it. Because we had New Vrindavan devotees come and tell us, what's the matter? It was authorized. You know? Everybody knew it. No devotee would kill another devotee unless it was authorized. So we knew he had done it, you know. And yet, by going to the Indians like this, Kirtananda was going to try to force ISKCON in a position where we had to support him. We weren't going to have a choice. And he started going on television shows. He got an agent who booked him in media markets, television markets, radio and television shows all over America, on what was called the First Amendment Freedom Tour. The First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States guarantees freedom of religion. And so he was billing this investigation into murder. And also, when the government discovered how they were doing Sankirtan, there was also a huge criminal fraud operation involving, first of all, they were selling these stickers with Snoopy and Peanuts on it, to which they had not, they were pirated stickers. They didn't pay copyright royalties to the person. So everything they did, every time they shipped stickers out, that was fraud. They were collecting money. I mean, they're all over America collecting money in horrendous ways. I mean, we were all so fried with them, as bad as everybody else was. They were really bad. I mean, they were just out, the most outrageous. The government was investigating all of that. And he was on a First Amendment freedom tour. And we realized that we were really going to be in a problem if something isn't done. So we were having this North American Temple President Society, and he decided to come to that meeting and send his people for the first time. He claimed to have more Prabhupada disciples in New Vrindavan than anywhere else in ISKCON. And they descended in this meeting. And their purpose was to outvote everybody else and try to get an endorsement from the North American temple presidents and Prabhupada disciples. What he didn't know was that the only people that really had a vote were the temple presidents. The Prabhupada disciples were not really part of the official thing. But their leaders came, and we had this big, what a showdown that was. My life had been threatened by then. It was really heavy. Anyway, while all their leaders were there, while all their people were there, we passed a resolution requesting a GBC to expel Kirtananda from ISKCON. He certainly didn't expect that. He expected the GBC at the most would, suspend him from the GBC, but what we really needed him was out of ISKCON. So that we went to ISKCON with that proposal. So in the 87 Mayapur meeting, all this came to a head. The first thing was, before anything else, the GBC did vote to remove Kirtananda from ISKCON. By then, just as that meeting started, the same reporter who wrote this Crime in the Krishnas thing got together with another guy in a Rolling Stone magazine published an article called Dial Om for Murder. There's a famous mystery novel by Agatha Christie called Dial M for Murder. This was Dial Om for Murder. And it was about the murder of Sulochan. That was a national magazine. And that had an effect. Anyway, I can't, we're running out of time, but anyway, there was, the GBC did expel Kirtanananda from the movement. And then it did these other things. I hear the resolutions. Rameshwar is removed as a member of the GBC, and they mean also as initiating guru, and don't have to say it. Bhagavan's resignation is accepted by the GBC. Bhavananda is removed as a member of the GBC. Brahmananda was removed from the GBC. Oh, that was seemed to be another thing. And then it expelled Kirtanananda from ISKCON. Whereas Kirtananda Swami, by his words and deeds, has systematically obscured and minimized his divine grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada's preeminent position as the founder Acharya, while he's rejects the governing body commission, starting his own movement, misrepresents ISKCON to the public, the media, and the government, whereas indicated by GBC investigations, numerous serious illegal acts have occurred within his jurisdiction, he was expelled. Resolved that the GBC authorize a committee to execute the following mandate, which was this: set up the 50-man committee to interview each of the 17 existing GBC members and issue a vote of confidence or no confidence. They're supposed to interview one by one. The 50-man committee is supposed to interview each one and issue a vote of confidence or no confidence with a specific written list of points of rectification. And then the 50-man committee was to propose 10 additional candidates for GBC position. By then, the GBC was down to 17 members. It was very, very small, so they wanted to add new members to the GBC. And it gave guidelines for that. So then the committee of 50 got together. And we interviewed each GBC man, one after other, and issued... Well, we changed. Now I have to tell you what happened with Hari K. Swami on the 50-man committee, because I guess this is the place to tell the story. Finally.
Were you on the 50-man
committee? Yeah, I was on the 50-man committee. What we did is we divided into small groups, and each subcommittee took, you know, 3 or 5 GBC men. And they worked together and listed all the doubts and misgivings and problems that people had with them. And then we were going to call them in one by one and ask them questions. And each committee had its own questioner. After we did about 2 people, they decided that I had a knack for asking kind of heavy questions in a nice way. And so I was made the interrogator. But I would just sit there and they would hand me the notes and I would deal with them. And at that time two people came from Hari Kesha's zone with problems. One was Guru Gauranga, who was his zonal secretary, regional secretary in Switzerland, and they had a falling out and he was cast out into outer darkness. And Guru Gauranga came and informed us that at that time Hari Kesha Swami had his zone so organized that in effect every temple was in his possession. That Hari Kesha was very, very upset about this whole reform movement, and he thought ISKCON was going down, and he thought that kind of the BBT for him is at the helm was the lifeboat prepared for Prabhupada. And so he was prepared. He had all the properties in his name. He did this by having the properties under the control of a fiduciary agent in Liechtenstein, Frau somebody, I forgot her name. And but she was under his control, is what Guru Gauranga said. The other thing that happened is that Sariputta was sent in by Bhagavan as a spy into Harikesha's zone to find out what was going on with UFOs. At that time, there was a research faculty headed by Aganoth, where they were trying to build free energy machines. You put in a certain amount of energy and more comes out. I guess it's the modern version of a perpetual motion machine. This is apparently supposed to be the propulsion unit of a UFO. And by this, ISKCON was going to solve all of its financial problems by having an essential oil wells, you know, that produce infinite amount of oil, free energy. And so they were researching this, and I guess from some people, some UFO groups had the mathematical formulas and everything like that, and instructions how to build these machines, so they were attempting to build them. Sariputta looked at the formulas and he reported that the mathematics was nonsense. It was just gibberish. It didn't make sense. That was his judgment anyway. So he came back and he was on the 50-man committee and says, Guru Gauranga, they told us, he told us about these UFOs. So the group that was dealing with Harikesha Swami decided that the UFO thing was just too much and we were going to talk about that. And we should be single-minded and just wanted to talk about the properties. So I had the questions in front of me, so Harikesh sat down and he was very, very upset at having this 50-man committee subject himself to this. And so I said to him, but something like this, I understand that in your zone all the properties, BBT properties and ISKCON properties, are in your name. He said, no, they're not. I said they're in the control of a fiduciary agent named Frau so-and-so in Liechtenstein. At this point he looks over at Guru Gauranga and realizes what's happened. But that actually you're controller. Will you explain us what is the arrangement with this fiduciary agent? And he said, it's too difficult for ordinary people to understand. And I said, well, why don't you try and explain it to us anyway? So he started talking and it was incomprehensible. Like nobody could make sense of it. So I said, okay, well, and I said to Guru Gauranga, well, why don't you explain to us? Will you explain this? What do you understand this arrangement? You explain it to us? So he explained it, very clear, simple, precise, and easy to understand how the fiduciary agent worked and how she was under the control of Harikesha Swami. Very easy to understand. So then I said to Harikesha, you just heard Guru Gauranga's explanation. Is there anything wrong with it? It's a good answer, because it was accurate. Aren't you going to ask me about flying saucers? Like that. And I says, okay, tell us about flying saucers. And then, man, he just exploded. And he said, you fools. Something like that. Don't you understand? Prabhupada wanted us to be able to get energy out of the ether. And he started to go on about our lack of vision, our lack of understanding, that certain people are in a position that nobody else can really judge them because they're such superior beings. And that in the course of this tirade, he really lambasted Sariputta like crazy. I mean, just Sariputta at that point was a very popular person. Among and lambasted Sariputta, and then told us in a very thinly veiled way that if we did something he didn't like, he was just going to leave with the BBT, with all the properties, and with his disciples. He left the room, and people were sort of shook. were really shook up by this tirade. And as soon as he left the room, somebody said he's crazy. It was just an amazing performance. And then somebody else says, my God, we can't vote no confidence in him. If we do, he'll leave the movement. We have to vote confidence in him. Well, we had just talked to somebody else, another GBC, and they had already decided to vote no confidence in him. So I pointed this out. I said, how can you vote no confidence in somebody, and then somebody else comes along that you think is worse? In fact, he's so much worse that you have to give him a vote of confidence. I said, that's not fair. You know, that's just not right. And so we then changed our procedure that instead of one up or down vote, we would say we have confidence in a person because of this and no confidence because of that. And so, you know, report cards were issued to every GBC, and they met and we discussed what we thought they should do to rectify themselves in the Committee of 50. And I don't remember, actually, Jai Dwaitaswami wrote them all up. He was the writer, like Jeremiah the prophet, you know, thunderbolts. You know. He wrote them all up. And with Hari Kesha, his program of rectification was put the properties back in ISKCON's name. And that did happen over the next year. Now, from this, you know, there were some people, some GBCs who are behind this kind of reform in the zonal acharya system. Some people were half convinced, half apprehensive. There's some people who are really against it. You know, I could see that, and in some ways, this whole thing was a compromise. Oh, the other thing that happened is then the Committee of 50 put up nominations for people to come to the GBC, and that's how I got on the GBC. I didn't realize that if you lead a successful revolution, you get put on the government, which becomes much harder than anything else. So there was a whole bunch of people added to the GBC at that time. Some were still on there. Myself, Ganapati Swami, Agrani Swami, Naranjana Swami, Hari Vilas, Kavichandra, Yasomati Nandana, Guru Prasad Maharaj, Bhakti Bhushan Maharaj, Dhanavir Prabhu, Shivaram Maharaj, Bhakti True Maharaj, Gauravinda Maharaj, Vikodar Prabhu, Prithu Prabhu. So that's all these people were added to the GBC. It was a new body in many cases. So that's what happened. I realized that my realization was that Krishna didn't, to go any further than we, my understanding is that if we tried to go any further than we went in 1987, the movement would fall apart. Because Archana and some other people, when I told them what happened on this occasion with Hari Kesh, why didn't you tell us? Why did you keep this hidden? You know, you thought he was crazy then.
Archana
in Germany. Archana, you know, or Hari Balava. Anyway, they're disciples of Hari Kesh in Germany, and they're really against keeping anything secret now. You know, and that, you know, when this happened with Hari Kesh, we didn't do anything. And, you know, how could we go on with somebody on the GBC and let him be an initiating guru when we thought he was disturbed? But our overriding concern was the unity of ISKCON. We didn't want to see ISKCON fall apart. And so, in a sense, some people in the reform movement thought we had compromised. I mean, the people who were really mad were the people who later became the Ritviks. And what they really wanted to see was anybody who had been part of the original acharyas should be out. I mean, they really were out for blood. And I could see that the people that were really gone were the people that were fallen. And those are the ones that Krishna wanted removed. And everybody else, he seemed to me that was Krishna's indication that he wanted them to stay. One thing that I discovered in this process of reform myself is that if I kept my sadhana good, very well, and I tried very hard to be detached But I could see Krishna at work. I mean, it was really a nice thing, actually. It was almost like that. The emergency meeting was like the Battle of Kurukshetra. You know, I could see just Krishna's picking up people and moving them around, you know.
Which one?
Emergency meeting in New Vrindavan. Right. I mean, like, you could just see that Krishna was working. You know, it was wonderful to see, actually. And even in the middle of these tense situations, you know, there was just patterns to coincidence and things happening, and it was just clear to me. I could see him. And so I realized that, you know, Krishna was in control of this whole process, not me, not anybody else, and that just like Prabhupada didn't want anybody unnecessarily removed, kicked out, who had at least a chance of going on in a productive way. So as far as Harikesh, I thought there were real problems, and I thought, well, you know, we'll deal with this later. There's next year, and there's next year, and there's next year. Anyway, I came on the GBC, and you know that Harikesh didn't really go to the GBC meetings for 2 years. The report came he was sick, he was prostrate, he was near death, and all these other kinds of things. And then when he showed up again on the GBC, he was really different. He was really, really different. I always found him very difficult to work with. But suddenly I could work with him, it seemed reasonable, could get along. But he complained, he said, only half of my brain is functioning. Now we know what happened. After that GBC meeting in 87, he came back and he had a real breakdown. And that's when Chiteshwar began giving him Stelazine. I don't know what it's called in Europe, but the American brand name is Stelazine, this drug. It used to be given in the 60s to bring people off of bad LSD trips. It's an antipsychotic medication. And in this Vibhuti, there was this Stelazine, and he started taking it. That's why I said only half his brain was working. That's what it does. It slows you down. And so, you know, he was behaving quite differently, and we could get along together, and we managed to work together on some things pretty well. So whatever problems he had, I think, were masked and covered over by this. The trouble about drugs is they don't solve your problems. They just keep them from manifesting for a while. When he stopped taking it January of last year, everything came back again. And he thought of the Russian stock market as another free energy machine where just stuff would come out of the ether, you know, like that, with this kind of exuberant over-expectation of these things. So that's what happened in this 87 meeting. Now I just want to take a minute to. There's a whole lot of stuff in here, and we have to kind of look back a little bit and say, you know, what went wrong and what to do about this this whole thing. And I think what really went wrong is just an artifact of the conditions under which Prabhupada was working. The quality of the people he had, the demands of growth, the need to make leaders who were not so advanced take a leadership position. And it looked like people were fairly advanced, and turned out not to be so advanced. And I think we can find out what went wrong when we look at Chaitanya Charitamrita, where there's the discussion in the Majja Lila 19, text 159, of different weeds that grow up. It says the watering process, when the creeper of devotional service is watered, weeds are also watered. Some unnecessary creepers growing up with the bhakti creeper are the creeper of behavior unacceptable for those trying to attain perfection, nisiddhachar. Diplomatic behavior, kutinati, which means duplicitous behavior in Prabhupada's language, being two-faced, backbiting. Jiva himsa, unnecessary killing of the animal or the soul. Labha, profit according to material calculations. Puja, adoration achieved to satisfy mundane people. And pratishta, becoming an important person in material calculation. All these are unwanted creepers. So these creepers are described, these weeds. And I don't need to go into all the description. Most of us know about these kinds of things. But I have to say, in some ways, I think these weeds became almost part of the institution. Puja, pratishta, people had achieved these positions, and sometimes it went to their head. I know that part of the Dzogchenacharya system, the thing that really shocked me the most was the extent of which I thought Vaishnava aparad was going on, and was thought to be normal management. It was thought actually that the only time you could make a Vaishnava aparad were those who were superior to you, but as those far as your equals or below you, you could say anything you wanted. And there was a huge amount of bad talk all the time. But Prabhupada says, after all these obstructions have been described in this verse as unwanted creepers. They simply present obstacles for the real creeper, the Bhakti Lata. And then there's this interesting statement. One should be very careful to avoid all these unwanted things. These are anarthas. Sometimes these unwanted creepers look exactly like the Bhakti creeper. Notice that they look exactly like it. They appear to be of the same size and same species when they are packed together with the Bhakti creeper. But in spite of these things, the creepers are called upashaka, unwanted. A pure devotee can distinguish between the Bhakti creeper and the mundane creeper, and he's very alert to distinguish them and keep them separate. Well, I think that is the problem. It looks like advancement in Krishna consciousness. It looks just like you're getting better and better, bigger and bigger, more and more successful. Look at what we've done to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. Look at the book distribution scores. Look at the shaved up head points. But in some ways, it turned to be a kind of false advancement. He goes on to say, if one chants the Hare Krishna mantra while committing offenses, these unwanted creepers will grow. And then Prabhupada says a little more precisely, the unwanted creepers have been described by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He states that if one hears and chants without trying to give up offenses, one becomes materially attached to sense gratification. So it's not exactly that Prabhupada is saying one has to be on the offenseless platform, but one has to hear and chant while trying to give up offenses. That is the most concise definition I know of good sadhana, that you have to chant while trying to give up offenses. If we do so, we're on the, at least on the clearing platform. And when you're on the clearing platform, you don't experience the pure name, but we experience the dawning twilight of the holy name, Nama Bas, which, according to Haridas Thakur, destroys all sinful reactions and is enough to bring liberation. The pure name gives Krishna prema. So one has to be chanting while trying to give up offenses. And this, I think, was the big neglect in ISKCON. People were chanting the holy name, but they were, for example, maintaining material desires, fault-finding with devotees, and not trying to give these things up. That, I think, was the real problem. And so how to rectify matters is explained. We want to know what to do. If we see this is really the problem, it's ultimately a spiritual problem. All right. what to do. How do we see about how this movement is going on? I don't think it just depends upon the leaders, as I said. I think it depends upon every single devotee. Describes in the Chaitanya Charitamrita how Lord Chaitanya cleaned the Gundicha temple. And commenting on the cleaning of the Gundicha temple, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, as the world leader, was personally giving instructions on how one should receive Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, within one's cleansed and pacified heart. If one wants to see Krishna seated in his heart, he must first cleanse the heart. And he talks about how in this age there's particularly a lot of dirty stuff in the heart. If then he says, if a devotee at all wants to cleanse his heart, he must chant and hear the glories of the Lord, Sri Krishna, Srinivasa Krishna. This is a simple process. Krishna himself will help cleanse the heart because he is already seated there. And that's an important point. It's not that we do it ourselves. We ask Krishna to do it, and who's already all-powerful. He's already seated there. Krishna wants to continue living within the heart. And the Lord wants to give directions. But one has to keep his heart as clean as Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu kept the Gundicha temple. So he says the Lord wants to give directions. We're wondering about how our movement will be conducted, how directions will go on, how we will be properly guided. Krishna wants to give directions. And the devotee therefore has to cleanse his heart just as the Lord cleansed Gundicha Mandir. So in this way we're given these instructions about what we're supposed to do. The instructions are really there. As I said, the problem is not that one has to be on the thoroughly pure platform, but one has to become from ulterior motives, as explained here. Our motive has to be pure, that we want pure Krishna consciousness, and then we have to pray to Krishna to become free of all these unwanted things. In this purport, Prabhupada again goes back to these weeds. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur explains that even though one may become free from the desire for fruitive activity, sometimes the subtle desire for fruitive activity again comes into being within the heart. He's talking about how Lord Chaitanya, he cleaned the temple, then he went back and cleaned it again. Then he went back and cleaned it again. So he's saying this is the fact that you may clean the temple. There may not be obvious desires for fruitive activities, but just assume that they're subtle desires. One often thinks of conducting business to improve devotional activity, but the contamination is so strong that it may later develop into misunderstanding, described as kutinati, fault finding, and pratishta, the desire for name and fame and for high position, jiva himsa, envy of other living entities, nisidachar, accepting things forbidden in the shastra, kama, desire for material gain, and puja, hanking for popularity. Then he concludes this list by saying, gradually one desires to become a reputed devotee or an avatar incarnation. So that's the simple desire. And Prabhupada said this cleansing process is called anartha nirvritti, cleansing the heart of all wanted things. So I think the deficiency of ISKCON has been in insufficient attention to this anartha nirvritti. Whoever is pure, whoever can actually follow Krishna's direction, that person Krishna will empower. That's what we understand. So we have this issue of leadership, how to be sure ISKCON is guided by Krishna. It's really a simple procedure, and Prabhupada states it very easily in different places. Like from the preface of Nectar of Instruction, Prabhupada says, in all spiritual affairs, one's first duty is to control his mind and senses. Unless one controls his mind and senses, one cannot make any advancement in spiritual life. Everyone within this material world is engrossed in the modes of passion and ignorance. One must promote himself to the platform of goodness, Sattva-guna, by following the instructions of Rupa Goswami, and then everything concerning how to make further progress will be revealed. Prabhupada's really commenting on the first verse, Vacho Vegam Manasakrodha Vegam Jiva. One has to control these six sense gratifying agents. And Prabhupada said, then you come to this platform, just the mode of goodness. Mode of goodness is not that much, but in the context of devotional service, it allows us to hear and to receive and be guided by the direction of Krishna. Everything, how to make further progress, will be further revealed. Oh, and here's the verse I was trying to tell you about. A foolish person who manufactures his own ways and means through mental speculation and does not recognize the authority of the sages who lay down unimpeachable directions is simply unsuccessful again and again in his attempts. The Prabhupada says that a conditioned soul has these four defects. And then he says, consequently, we have to take direction from liberated persons. This Krishna consciousness movement directly receives instructions. Notice this far out sentence. This Krishna consciousness movement directly receives instructions from the Supreme Personality of Godhead via persons who are strictly following his instructions. So first of all, he says direct and then via, which is an interesting, seems like a contradiction, but what Prabhupada wants to say is he's talking about transparency. If the via media is transparent, then it's direct, even though there is a media or a medium. He says, consequently, we have to take directions from liberated persons. This Krishna consciousness movement directly receives instructions from the Supreme Personality of Godhead via persons who are, because of the previous sentence, we expect to see the word liberated. But instead, he says, via persons who are strictly following his instructions. This is a surprise, and Prabhupada notes this, because he says, although a follower may not be a liberated person, if he follows the Supreme Liberated Personality of Godhead, his actions are naturally liberated from the contamination of material nature. Notice what he says is a kind of Lord Chaitanya therefore says, by my order you may become a spiritual master. That's the Amara Ajnaya Guruhana. One can immediately become a spiritual master by having full faith in the transcendental words of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and by following his instructions. So that's the requirement. And in this way, Prabhupada's also echoing this statement by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, where he says that the secret of success is to take the order of the spiritual master as one's life and soul, and one should not be concerned whether one is liberated or not liberated. There's an implicit reference to this there, which is Prabhupada's teaching. So what Prabhupada gives us to do here is instructions that actually anyone can follow. You say, well, I had to be liberated, how long will that take? He says, no, this is what you have to do. You simply, what liberated practically means is that you're strictly following. I mean, maybe some in the future you won't be able to be strictly following, but that's another thing. But if you are strictly following, then you'll be able to correctly give directions for the Krishna consciousness movement. So I think that's, to me, is the at the basis what went wrong and what we have to do to correct it. I think there are other issues about strictly following Prabhupada's direction, trying to understand what kind of changes the Krishna consciousness movement is going through. And that's the other thing. One should not be so discouraged that there's so many difficulties. Because one, we're trying to do something that's pretty heavy. trying to take a religious tradition out of one culture and one circumstances and transplant it into another. How to have a worldwide movement under the direction of a board of directors in which there are many gurus and many different disciples all working together in harmony. The Gaudiya Mutt was unable to do it. We tried one thing in ISKCON. We thought we did it right and turned out to be not right. We're trying something else. I don't think that the original people or the Zonal Acharya system was certainly not something that's against our philosophy or unbona fide. It's just not exactly what Prabhupada wanted. And at first we thought, you know, this is the way we're going to put the gurus in ISKCON. Turned out to be wrong. I don't know how any other way you can find these things out except sometimes by trying something. If it doesn't work, go back and fix it and try again. That's how you go forward by this method, because we're putting Krishna consciousness into new circumstances. So that's not surprising that it's difficult. The Gaudiya Mutt tried and failed. We're working at it. I don't think we've failed. I think we're on the way to fixing that particular thing. And the other thing is just an artifact of the fact that we're a young movement, that Prabhupada had to do this all by himself, that he didn't have any help from his god brothers or institutions, that the people that he worked in a short amount of time, that Krishna sent him people that were not mature or very qualified in many respects. And you know, it's to me, you know, you may think, well, why did so many things go wrong? But the other thing you say, it's amazing so much went right. Look at all the service Prabhupada got out of very unpromising people. And I still my conviction that it was Prabhupada's understanding that bad things are going to happen, because Krishna says himself that all endeavor there's fault. Like when there's a fire, there's going to be smoke. So there's always going to be some endeavor there's going to be something wrong, but that's no reason not to do it. And when you're a total perfectionist, you never do anything. Nothing gets accomplished. And Prabhupada understood that the good will be eternal and the bad will be temporary. That's my assessment of this situation. So, comments, questions, doubts, fears, misgivings? What do you think? Think we can go on? Yeah?
For this system which the Prabhupada established in 77, so this initiation through his followers like Kirtananda, Chin, and others, is there something like that in the tradition before the Guru's initiation through someone?
No. You mean the Ritvik?
Yeah.
Oh, while he's still around, yes. I think that's I don't know where the name Ritvik came. But it was actually Prabhupada's original plan. He mentions in a letter that you can see in this letter and also in Easy Journey to Other Planets. Prabhupada's plan was that he would train people as devotees, then under his supervision they would begin acting as initiating gurus. He said in one letter, by 1975, I want my students to begin initiating. He wasn't planning to be gone by 1975. But he had talked about in Nectar and Easy Journey to the Other Planet this idea of monitor guru. Somebody like a monitor is a student teacher who teaches under the supervision of an accomplished teacher. And then when he talked about this examination system, when people got the Bhaktivedanta degree, then they could begin to initiate. So Prabhupada, to my mind, he had a very clear plan in mind, that he would train people in Krishna consciousness, they become more learned in the scriptures, they would study for the Bhakti Shastri, then Bhakti Bhai Bhava, then Bhakti Vedanta, when he agreed that they were ready, they would begin to initiate, like these Ritviks. They would do everything, but they would still be supervised by Prabhupada. Then when Prabhupada left, they would become gurus in their own rights. I think that was Prabhupada's long-term plan. This is the standard way of education in all cultures up until recent times. If you look at the Middle Ages in Europe, this was the system: bachelor and then master. And it was really based on how the craft guilds would work. You would first become an apprentice or a bachelor under a master, and you would learn the trade. Then you would become what they call in English a journeyman. You wouldn't be a master yourself, but under the supervision of a master you could practice. So this was in the universities. There was the bachelor's degree. Bachelor meant brahmachari, really. You would study under a master. Then you got the bachelor's degree. Then you were qualified to teach others under supervision and write under supervision. Then when you're fully qualified, you became a master yourself. That's the so-called master's degree. And then if you became really learned, you became a doctor, which meant really learned. This is the standard form of education and training. First, you're an apprentice. Then you serve as a student under the master. Then you're out of your apprenticeship. You spend time practicing the trade under supervision. And then you can finally become independent. And this is what Prabhupada had planned in mind. And I think because of various circumstances, because his devotees weren't advancing fast enough, like they never started this degree program, that by 1975 nobody was ready. That at the end, he just kind of put this into effect very fast with the Ritvik thing. And I guess it was undetermined how long Prabhupada would be around. That's where I think this structure comes from. I think it was Prabhupada's original plan to do it like that. And circumstances kind of didn't let it happen the way he had hoped. Okay? Yeah?
What is your understanding about this reinitiation issue?
Well, that became a big controversy. That's what sparked off the first big Ritvik thing a few years after all this. These are the people who were dissatisfied. When the question came up, there was a GBC research committee, and I participated at least in part of that research. And what we discovered is that, as far as we could see, that the acharyas would say that if the spiritual master falls down and becomes hopeless and things like that, then they say Punar Mantra Grahan. This is Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Jiva Goswami, that one should again take the mantra. This is their recommendation. And that's there, and I can't do anything about it. People draw the conclusion from this, which I think is an illicit conclusion, that if you do not get reinitiated, you have no connection with the Sampradaya. In other words, if your spiritual master falls down, your connection with the Sampradaya is broken, and that in order to reconnect, you have to get reinitiated. This is what people deduce from this fact. I think that's a false deduction, because it's clear that people still do have a connection. They still have a connection with Srila Prabhupada. They have association of devotees, and people can still continue to make spiritual advancement, even though their spiritual master has fallen down. Then you can say, well, if that's the case, why reinitiation? All I can say is, there it is. That's what they say. I would not do it unless you were clear that that was what you need to do in order to make further progress in Krishna consciousness. In other words, think of it as something that's recommended by the acharyas. Think of yourself in a position that you're doing everything you can to make spiritual advancement. Actually, if we're doing everything we can to make spiritual advancement in the circumstances we're in, Krishna always lets us know what the next step is. Sometimes he doesn't let you see very far ahead, but he'll always let you know what the next step is, if Krishna's convinced you're going to take it. If you're not going to take it, he won't bother to waste his time showing it to you. But if you're sincere about advancement, he'll always let you know what the next step is. So keep on practicing Krishna consciousness so that you make advancement. And then if at a certain point what one needs to do in order to make further advancement is, again, that particular kind of shelter of a devotee in whom you have faith, then don't hesitate. Go ahead and do it. If you make advancement without it, that's what's now what's indicated. Go on like you are. It's clear that you're not disconnected. That's to me is the false inference. Well, people would get in anxiety and think, "Oh, I have to be reinitiated, otherwise I have no position." Like some kind of magic act. That's not the case. You do have you have a position. Prabhupada is everyone's Shiksha Guru. I'm sure if one of Prabhupada's disciples fails, especially as the grand spiritual master, he steps in and takes special care of the devotees. I know this happens. I wouldn't be in anxiety. If you want Krishna consciousness, you can have it no matter what happens. Krishna will move heaven and earth to make sure you get Krishna consciousness. So you should be reassured of that. Is that okay? Are you clear now? You just want a yes or no?
No,
it's not too complicated.
No, that's very good. Okay. I was thrown into, because now we have in ISKCON so many devotees who have been in a situation where they have been reinitiated a number of times.
I know, it's terrible. Isn't it horrible? It really is. I can understand why people are reluctant. God, why should I go through this again? You know? So I don't think there's any hurry. And you certainly, if you don't have faith in somebody, or that faith isn't there, don't take reinitiation.
That's what you can get into if you become a victim of this misunderstanding. You're supposed to that you have to take it.
Yeah, sure. You have to do it to be connected. I don't think that's true. I think that's a false inference. It's clear that people are connected. Yes?
Yeah, I don't know how much it matters now, but it's a little difficult for me to recognize the way you were describing Narakesha Swami's reaction to this reform movement.
Yeah.
Because it seemed to us here that he jumped on the opportunity to get off the theater.
Yeah, I think that part of it he didn't. He
said he'd been always like speaking about that, but he didn't want to break up the unity.
Yeah. He told us that. I believe that's true. I think he had mixed feelings. You know, some of it he liked, and some of it he was deeply.
I think it was just
suspicious.
Of breaking up the faith of the disciples.
Maybe.
I think that's a valid feeling.
I could not read his mind, but I tell you how he reacted. He was very, very, very upset. But he told us that he was always against this Vyasasana thing, didn't like it. And I believed him. I mean, I didn't think he was... Huh?
I can say that in the beginning, here in Sweden, we were... First, there was simultaneous Guru Puja. But he was quite quick to change that. And also, while that was going on, he actually didn't like when the God brothers came and offered flowers.
Yeah.
So at least from that part.
Yeah.
That was the
great. Sure. Sure. Uh-huh.
And then there's another aspect.
Yeah. See, he was off and I never had much to do with him. He was off in another part of Europe. The people I had to deal with, you know, in America, I knew pretty well. So it was a bit of a mystery to me what was actually going on. The only other time, the only other dealings we had with him was when the whole incident involving Bhakti Dayal in Hungary. he was, I guess, having some association with Sridhar Maharaj, and there was a raid on his headquarters in Vienna. Remember that one?
84.
Yeah, and it was apparently things were really, really heavy. And he came to North America to complain about it. Huh? Yeah. And so several of us went to a GBC meeting in Miami, and all he wanted was that, because Hari K. Swami had just written a letter kicking him out of ISKCON, and we wanted that he should at least have some kind of due process or a fair trial. And so we went to bat for him to get that. And he did have some kind of a hearing in front of the GBC, I guess, in 86. They did do that. I thought it was not so bad, but by then he had fallen under the influence of Tripurari, unfortunately, and left ISKCON. It's too bad. But that was the only other occasion I had to deal with issues over in this particular zone. So I just describe what happened in the Committee of 50. I think it's a pretty accurate description.
How many of the 17 GBC members got the vote of confidence?
Well, we changed the system. So with everybody, it was we like this and we don't like this. So it wasn't one up down and one another. You know, I hardly remember. There was a thing of rectification. We sat down with them, and I don't remember. I think those report cards are supposed to be stashed somewhere in Mayapur. Nobody was allowed to take it, copy out, so I don't have them in my files. But they're maybe still there. They may have mysteriously disappeared. I don't know. I don't know. And it took a while, but then the GBC began to work. I thought we began to work together fairly well, actually, in many things.
How about today? How is the atmosphere in the GBC?
Hmm?
The atmosphere in the GBC now, at present?
I think it's pretty good. I think we do have the capacity to work together fairly cooperatively. I think most of us feel sort of overwhelmed by the number of things we have to deal with and that we can't deal with. That's something of a problem right now. It's clear to the GBC that just having this committee that meets once a year is not enough to run ISKCON. And that we need to augment or supplement the structure of the GBC. Most GBC are overwhelmed with the amount of things they have to do in their own zones. And basically, we don't have, I think we don't have the money for a kind of permanent government in ISKCON, which is what we really need. The movement has just gone too big and too complex to go on without a permanent government. So we're just struggling to find a way to handle all these things. I think that's our biggest problem. And the other thing we have to deal with is Ritvik issue and this poison issue, and GBC has been sued in court and all these other kind of things. And
GBC has been sued in court in Calcutta.
Yeah, and also Bangalore, two places now.
Plus this and you. Yeah. By the
yeah, maybe that'll happen. I don't know if it's really going to happen in North America. Yeah. So, but
it's not for certain that will happen.
I don't think they've initiated a lawsuit. They're trying to get this lawyer named Turley to take this case on. He's the one that won $24 million from the Rath Roman Catholic Church in Dallas.
The way it's being presented on the internet is like it's already been accepted and that they're fighting
Yeah, I'm not so sure it's true. I'd be really surprised, actually. I mean, that'd be really interesting if they're doing it. I wonder why. Because Turley and these people, they work on what's called a contingency fee basis. I mean, you sue somebody and the jury gives a reward. They give two kinds of damages. They're called compensatory, to compensate you for the injury done to you, and punitive. Punitive, to punish the person so they'll never do it again. In these cases in America, juries have been giving huge awards of punitive damages, especially if it's against a corporation. Lawyers take on this case. They say, if we lose, you don't have to pay anything. If we win, we get 30%, or whatever it is you win. Huh? Yeah. They did that in this big tobacco lawsuit, and the lawyers were making literally billions of dollars, and the government stepped in and stopped it because they were making so much money. Billions and billions of dollars, because there was so much money involved in this punitive settlement. So that's what they say, something like that. The percentage, I guess, you work out, but I think it's usually 25-30% the lawyers will take. So to be able to collect punitive damages, there has to be money. So the Roman Catholic Church, I'm sure Purunjan and those people or Prachitosh convinced them, yeah, there's millions of dollars, the gurus all have a fortune. Yeah. But I don't think it's there. They can't seize the actual temple buildings. That the government wouldn't allow them. No. Because they're religious buildings. It's a free exercise of religion. They would stop them. We've been through this with the Robin George case. They could not get the actual temple. They could get apartment buildings that the temple owns, houses that the temple owns, shopping malls that the temple owns, you know, whatever property. But I don't know of any temples that have that. There's very little money.
But you know, in LA they have a lot of money.
Yeah, but nothing like millions of dollars worth. Maybe a few million dollars. The Turley will spend that much in a week just researching this case. So then they must have convinced them that, you know, Tamal Krishna Goswami or Jayapataka Swami or somebody has got a fortune stashed away. I tend to think that's an urban myth, that people have these huge savings anywhere, because I know how people live. And even if people had money, I'm not so sure they could get it. So I'd be really surprised if they actually take this case and go forward with it. I just don't think there's that much available to make it worth their while.
So that's good news.
Well, yeah, and so these people, if you read the other side, they may have already started. ITHCON's already finished. It's wiped out. We're going ahead with a new regime, but it hasn't happened yet. I don't know where the money is. I just don't know where it is to make it worthwhile. What I think they've been dealing with is not with Turley himself, but one of his assistants. And when Turley finally goes and looks at the thing, he won't do it.
Shouldn't
ITHCON
just hand over themselves and make them confess and get?
Yeah, well, we do that now, but these are things that happened 20 years ago, 30 years ago. No. And in another country, too. Yeah. You know, there's a statute of limitations that's passed for criminal cases, and probably for civil, a lot of it, you know, is also too late. Anything else you want to talk about all this stuff? Yeah? I wouldn't read it. That's what I do. I just stopped, you know. The internet is a real artifact of Kali Yuga in some ways. what I see is happening is now the empowerment of the active foolish. You take somebody who 10 years ago would have stood on a street corner handing out badly printed sheets with some ranting and raving, and everybody would say, oh, this guy's a nut. He now has a website that looks like the Vatican. It's just amazing what people can do. Communications has its downside, especially when everybody can communicate with everybody else. So the web gives facilities to a lot of people. And something about the internet is there's not a very high level, some reason or other, of responsibility for truthfulness. Like ordinarily, if you publish something, you're held to some account for truthfulness or reliability. But there's the karmas of notices, and the internet, sheer gossip and speculation can be thrown around like truth with complete irresponsibility. There's something about the medium that's like that. And so it's really very, very difficult all around. I don't think anybody knows quite how to do with it, to deal with it. It takes something that's make things very, very, very bad. I mean, the wildest stuff. Now, outside of ISKCON, the wildest stuff is out there about almost everything. Allegations and speculations and so on like that. And it's just a part of a whole new thing. So there are just hundreds of hate groups, you know, pouring the stuff out like crazy. There's an organization, I think it's called Hate Watch, that monitor hate groups. And you can go to these websites and see what people are saying. It kind of makes you feel better. That's what some of these people are into. The virulence of it is just amazing. I don't think there's anything you can do about it except tolerate it. And for me, I pretty much, unless I really have to, I don't look at all this stuff. It's just too much. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. You look at it.
Yeah.
No, not really. And besides, I don't look at 9 symptoms.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't do it.
There's one that's really. I mean, you want to. For me, it was a horrifying experience. I found one place called Deja News, and it's a search engine for news groups where people sit in and talk. And so I just type in my name. And find out all of these texts and what people are saying. It's just outrageous, you know.
How about you?
Yeah, I typed in my own name, you know. Jesus.
I think why you were so successful in the text when you wrote that, it has such an effect, because there was no internet. Because if you would have written what you wrote here on the internet, it would just be another text on the internet.
Yeah, may have just, yeah, right.
But now, mm-hmm. because that's had a different impact,
mm-hmm.
when you get it at that time.
Yeah, it's probably true. Yeah.
Doesn't it, though, this internet have the indirect effect that there's a lot more openness, because we know that if we try to suppress facts, they will be out there anyway, so that's the law that's come out of the open.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, I guess that has its downside, but that's part of it, that things come out. Openness also has its downside. It's actually, Prabhupada wasn't too happy with it.
What do you mean by that?
When one of the sannyasi fell down, and it was broadcast all throughout the movement by the gossip circuit, Prabhupada got very, very upset. He said, now that his fall down has been talked about so much, it will make it very difficult for him to come back. and Prabhupada didn't want it broadcast. And that was his general policy. If we did that, we'd be accused of covering up. And I think the Prabhupada, I don't think that the Prabhupada policy thought was the best policy was, you know, not to tell everybody everything about everything all the time. I don't think Prabhupada approved of that, but at this point, I don't think you have any choice, because it'll be considered you're just trying to cover up. And, you know, sometimes people do things that are maybe not so good, but in circumstances that are understandable and it's not so bad. But the other thing is when they get reported, they get amplified and exaggerated and built up. And you sort of don't want to tell anybody simply because how people will take it and spin it. And I have to tell people anyway. And I think a lot of good people get harmed by that. I think that's the downside of it. But that's what Prabhupada, that was Prabhupada's reaction to that kind of thing. But I say I at this point I just don't think you can do it. You can have that policy. I think in some ways you're worse off for it. But that's the way it is now. Right now people think, you know, not telling everything is the worst possible sin. In 10 years it'll change back. Everybody's going to get so sick of openness and everything. Can we just have a little, you know, keep it to yourself, you know. I mean, you can't have civilization without a little hypocrisy. If everybody sits down and tells everybody everything, my God, that's too much. Certain amount of hypocrisy makes for graceful living, huh? Don't put that on the tape. Cut that off. GVC endorses hypocrisy. See what happens.
It'll be an incident.
Anyway, thank you very much for listening to all this. I hope people are not discouraged in spite of all this stuff.
Now we've heard the naked truth, so you... Yeah, I mean, it's...
Happening, you know, I have to tell you some stuff.
I had virgin years, never even back in the counterculture, you know, hear all the, you know, dirty words and stuff. But, if we are somehow to maintain our kind of idealism and... commitment, loyalty, and our determination to be simple. I mean, can you be a simple devotee after finding out that this God was not the power that you would
be? Real simplicity is complicated, isn't it? Can you be simple without being a fool? I mean, I don't think this. I think simple and simple-minded are two different things. Huh? I really do. I said before, you know, you want to go from foolish idealism to foolish cynicism without passing through actual wisdom. Actual wisdom means you know what really happens, you know what the world is really like, and somehow you're still able to maintain your purposes and your ideals, even though you recognize what happens. And I think our purposes and ideals are perfectly fine. I think they're perfectly intact. I think the other thing is you know, I think a lot of devotees have not had a lot of experience outside of ISKCON, and they just don't understand how almost everything works. If you get an insight of any organization, you discover it's a mess. And the reason it works is there's a few people going day and night to keep things going in spite of everything. I was in a university department of religion, and I was absolutely amazed that every day professors stood in front of students and classes took place. I knew the political infighting that was going on, and a lot worse than the things in ISKCON. But people who are karmis do to each other is ruthless beyond belief. There was the political infighting. There was the sexual indiscretions. There was a good deal of real insanity. A huge amount of incompetence. And somehow or other, the institution kept on going. And I was amazed at that. And when you get inside of anything and you see, well, all you see is how something works, you know, like we look and we say, wow, you know, look at this, look at NATO, look what a great job it did, what together it was, you know, how many. You get in the inside and you see what's happening. It blows your mind how untogether it is and how it doesn't work. And just barely makes it through the day, you know. That's the way it is. And because we're idealists, that's the other thing. Idealists are like this. My youngest son started college at a small college in Ohio called Antioch. It's a very prestigious school, but has a real history of social activism and social idealism. This is its heritage, you know, and it's always trains the kids to go out and be activists and help the poor, help the needy, help the oppressed, you know. This is their real thing. It's a very idealistic school. So anyway, it's a small school. I went there to bring my son there. And so I went in and talked to one of the administration people who's running the scholarship programs he's part of. And this woman immediately started to tell me how screwed up Antioch was. This happened and we messed this up and this was supposed to happen and we're supposed to be like this, but we're really like this, and this is going wrong and this is going wrong. And I suddenly got this sense of, this sounds really familiar, you know. What does this remind me of? It reminds me of ISKCON. Immediately start telling you, we're supposed to be like this, and this happened and that happened and that happened. Then I realized I was in the presence of a real idealist. And it was the same kind of thing, you know. Because you always have these high expectations for yourself, these very high goals, these very high standards. And because of that, you're continually critical to yourself that we're not living up to it. I think that's fine. I think we should be like that. But if it becomes cynicism, it becomes discouragement, if it becomes disappointment, or fault finding, then we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. We are very, very high demand kind of group. And I just think, you know, discouragement is not allowed. And we see that Prabhupada had every possible reason to be discouraged, and he wasn't. And because he wasn't discouraged, we're here today, and I think that's a good thing. Prabhupada kept going. He could have stayed at home. He said, it's too much. I don't like the institution. You know, I'm just chanting Hare Krishna and swim in ecstasy. And he didn't. He came. So he was not discouraged. So it's just to me, it's not an option. And we will not get discouraged if we ourselves, if our personal practice of Krishna consciousness is in good order. Prabhupada said enthusiasm comes from following regular principles. That's what he said. And I think everybody can follow the regular principles. I think if you're in circumstances that make it difficult, you have to pray to Krishna, I'm having trouble, please help me. He'll send help. The fire engines will come. But if you're saying, don't help me, I'm having fun breaking the principles, then, you know, he doesn't help. It really depends upon us. And almost always when people make statements about ISKCON, it's almost always autobiography. You know, ISKCON won't work, it's failed, it's no good, there's no hope. They're talking about themselves. And because they're in that kind of state, the whole movement looks like that. But if they're in a spiritually advancing condition, then they always say, well, you know, ISKCON's not so bad. It always reflects our own state. It's very hard to really step out of that and say what it is or what it's like. That's a fact. So the way to be encouraged is in spite of everything, I mean, we have to say that, is to personally make sure that we're in a good spiritual state. That's the lesson I learned. And if you're in a good spiritual state, then you can help other people. And if you help other people, then you can help the movement. Because we should also always think that every individual has got leverage to help the movement. You don't have to be a big leader. You don't have to, because you associate with other people, you work together with other people, and your state of consciousness helps influence other people's state of consciousness. Everybody has got leverage. And if your association is positive, Krishna will make it so that your association becomes more and more shared by other people. You don't have to worry about it. Krishna will take care of it. Okay? My last statement. Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai.